Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to a special program, a program that is based upon almost 15 years of an in-depth investigation into the nature of AIDS. Today's program, AIDS, A Second Opinion, number 13. This program is meant to allow people a possibly broader perspective. Up to this point, we've held certain assumptions as being completely accurate, that HIV is the only cause of AIDS, that is transmitted primarily by unsafe sex or blood, that once you have tested positive to an antibody, that it is absolute that it, sooner or later you will develop full-blown AIDS and die, that there is no successful treatment at the moment, but you can make a difference by taking some of the antiretrovirals, such as AZT, DDI, DDC. The antibody test is accurate and is a standard. We are spending more money this year on AIDS than on cancer and heart disease research combined. But what if what we've been led to believe is challengeable? What if, in fact, virtually everything we've been taught about AIDS is wrong? This would make this the largest single medical fiasco in American history. How likely is it that individuals whose reputations and livelihoods and their own personal self-esteem would allow this to occur? Would they challenge it? Would they deny it? Would they accept irrefutable evidence? What's at stake? A great deal. Let's begin by looking at some of the, what I consider the myths of AIDS. And I ask you simply to examine the facts behind this research. Focus on the facts. At least you'll have a second opinion from which to decide whether you want to continue to support what I consider and a growing number of critics as being an unsupportable position. I'll begin by examining the sexual transmission of AIDS. I have discussed on previous investigations that AIDS has not spread into the general population. That is a fact. Now think back. Think back over the years of how we were absolutely certain that virtually every human being in the United States would be equally susceptible to this scourge. I had spoken with people in all walks of life from every community, from completely celibate individuals and monogamous couples who also felt threatened, even being around a person with AIDS, that a handshake, being in their mere presence, giving them a hug, could cause a transmission. The media kept us into a frenzy on this. We became paranoid, even staying away from people who we might even suspect might be at risk. But look carefully. AIDS has not gone outside of the high-risk groups. We've also made note that if physicians and scientists found a disease were confined to a certain group, this would be one clue in helping them to understand the illness. Of course, the ideal situation would be if the disease was confined to a single population group or, saving that, ones that are closely related. A difficulty with AIDS is that two of the major groups in the United States, which the illness strikes, male homosexuals and IV drug users, don't seem to share much in common. If we think merely of the first group for a moment and wonder why gays have been afflicted while straights generally have not, we might say that homosexual and heterosexuals tend to practice different types of sexual intercourse. So perhaps something in the difference between anal and vaginal intercourse is at the root of the disease susceptibility. This might seem a rather obvious conclusion, although one that has been blatantly overlooked by all the crusaders who have taken the AIDS crisis as an opportunity to decry any type of sex. Nonetheless, this is simply a hypothesis, and it may be well that some other difference between heterosexuals and homosexuals is responsible for the disparity in the groups contacting the illness. There is a great deal of evidence that, one, vaginal sex is not a route to transmission. But by looking at such subsets of the population as prostitutes, discordant couples where one partner has AIDS and the other does not, and spouses of infected hemophiliacs, we can document that AIDS is not generally spread by the way of vaginal intercourse, as well as suggest that there has been spread by heterosexuals. This may be due to anal sex or drug use rather than traditional intercourse. Number two, as a complement then, we must really examine the conclusions of researchers who have suggested anal intercourse is a prime means of spreading infection. However, there are admittedly puzzling elements that are not accounted for in this view. For one, the sperm of AIDS sufferers has been found to contain very low levels or no low levels of HIV. In fact, several years ago, I was working with a physician, a gay physician, who was strong in the gay community, supporting that AIDS was not sexually transmitted. In fact, he stated that he was going to determine how much of the HIV virus could be found in individuals who had died post-mortem examination of their sperm. Of 22 individuals who had died who had full-blown AIDS, or who had any combination of all the different 30 opportunistic infections that we call AIDS, there was no HIV found in any of the sperm of 21 of the individuals, and a virtually a non-detectable amount, only just a few cells, in the third. And we're talking about millions upon millions of sperm cells per person. So then he asked the question. He said, where is the HIV? If it's not in the sperm, and all these men were diagnosed and treated for AIDS, then where was it? And was that the means of being spread? Now, he believed that HIV was the cause of AIDS, but he just couldn't find that it was in the sperm. So how did these people get it? It raised issues, and unfortunately, instead of gathering around to examine this and to see whether or not his hypothesis could be sustained or rebutted, he was simply challenged outright for having undermine the gay community's position about staying together, having solidarity on this issue. You have to remember the political climate at the time. At that time, there was a Reagan view that this was not an important issue. There was not a primary funding for it, only token interest by the general population, as far as this is a major killer, because we didn't have most people suffering from it. In fact, most people never knew anyone who suffered from it. And so other gay doctors were challenging him. And in New York City, to be considered a pariah, that you're not supporting your own, meant that nobody would pay attention to you, journalists would not write about you, even in gay publications, except in a scourging way. So he was extremely disappointed. I wanted to see whether or not other heterosexual doctors would find his hypothesis interesting, that it wasn't spread primarily sexually, or at all sexually. They, too, found it somewhat interesting, but feared that if they took on the challenge, that they'd be going against the orthodox paradigm. So they backed off. So a very important early lead by Dr. Chiesa went begging for someone to follow through on it. Everyone was getting in step. And we tend to do that in our society, get in step behind a hypothesis. And overnight, hypotheses become, by their very dogma and how they're ritualistically supported, become fact. But it had not been proven a fact. This would be also something that I will examine in greater detail later on. In the subsection 3, we will We will be called on to entertain the speculation of some researchers who believe HIV is not sexually transmitted on any level. Some of them who espouse the fast lane theory argue that only those gays became infected who were engaging in heavy drug use and other activities that strain the immune system besides engaging in promiscuous sexual activity. Also, whatever the conclusions evidentially reached in this ongoing debate, one thing that remains the same in this controversy, as in so many others we've touched upon, is that popularized presentations adeptly ignore both the established facts, such as the lack of heterosexual transmission, and areas of controversy, such as whether anal sex is or is not a route of transmission, so that they can present hysterical screeds that cast more darkness than light on the subject. Let's go into this in some depth now. Let's first examine, is AIDS vaginally transmitted through vaginal intercourse? We can begin this discussion by looking at a number of populations in which, if vaginal transmission were a direct route of AIDS infection, the disease would have been expected to appear, but in which it has not surfaced. From there, we can move forward to more general remarks about heterosexual transmission. One group whose lack of infection seems to indicate the non-viability of heterosexual transmission is discordant couples in which one person who has AIDS but whose partner remain uninfected. According to Dr. Peter Duisberg, there are thousands of those. Although, to make his point more dramatically, he likes to point to celebrities who are in the public eye. He says, one of the most famous couples or examples is Arthur Ashe. He had HIV for 10 years and died of AIDS, but his wife and daughter are both HIV negative. They didn't have AIDS, and they don't have HIV. He might as well have cited, for example, Magic Johnson. He said, who is also HIV positive, and his wife and family are negative. Another place where we might have expected large numbers of AIDS cases with heterosexual transmission was rife is among heterosexual prostitutes. Here again, the statistics discount such a transmission route. The first point to make is that the low rate of infected prostitutes was totally unexpected by early researchers into AIDS, who confidently predicted that the disease, which began among AIDS, would use prostitutes as a conduit by which it would spread to heterosexuals. Hoskinson, in summarizing an article done by, and by the way, this is Dr. Neville Hodgkin, who was the science editor of the Times of London, which is arguably one of the most important editorial positions, and certainly in the area of science in the world. And he takes his work very seriously. And he first bought into the HIV equals AIDS equals death, and it is sexually transmitted concept. Later, he actually stopped long enough to examine the facts, something that American journalists have yet to do. It's amazing what changes when you actually examine facts. Not hysteria, not dogma, not political correctness, just facts. In summarizing an article done for the Wall Street Journal by Ruth Bernstein, notes, quote, a single HIV-infected female prostitute might, it was thought, infect dozens of heterosexual men and equal numbers of women through those men, unquote. Eventually, though, it was found few prostitutes in the United States became HIV positive. Between 5% and 7% of female prostitutes, now we're talking about street prostitutes now, are HIV-infected in major U.S. cities such as Los Angeles, unquote. But that doesn't end it. Those figures refer to prostitutes as a whole, but for New York City, the numbers have been broken out to look at them according to different classes. You have a higher rate of streetwalkers, the very low caste of prostitute, who had almost universally, almost 100% of those street prostitutes were IV drug users over the past decade, and they were HIV seropositive. Whether the streetwalkers had their immunosuppressive risks, such as non-HIV drug use, unprotected and anal intercourse, multiple sexual transmitted diseases, or anemia and malnutrition, that they have predisposed them to HIV and other infections has never been studied. Among call girls in New York City, a higher caste of prostitute, no seropositivity was found among those who were drug-free. Zero. These figures were constant between 1984 and 1989. As this citation makes clear, those prostitutes who did become infected, quote, almost all were intravenous drug abusers. Cases of sexually acquired HIV were almost unknown among prostitutes who did not take drugs, unquote. In fact, a 1997 article in Reappraising AIDS finds drug use as one of the most commonest transmission factors in all cases of female HIV positives. Quote, there is virtually no HIV to be found among American females who deny having injected drugs, unquote. I will not always give the citations, but these are all credible citations, just so I won't stop the flow of the commentary. But I will make these available to anyone who wishes to see that all my citations are based upon quality and independent review and statistically significant, let's say, disposition. And I have over 3,000 citations that I'll be sharing in my commentaries. So, and I will make all of this available on my webpage under scientific verification of anything I'm saying. So it is not my opinion, and therefore it is from independent scientific reference. While, in fact, there was only 1 in 10,000 women who gave blood for the first time test positive. This has to be contrasted to the high positivity found in drug users. In New York City, 38.6% of female drug users have HIV. In line with this, a 1993 report from the CDC found that out of 96% of AIDS patients in the United States, being those on which full data was available, only, quote, 10.1% of female AIDS patients deny being in high-risk groups, unquote. Those in high-risk groups include 32% who were HIV drug users, 20% with a history of prostitution, and 44% with a history of crack cocaine use, unquote. Moreover, to return to prostitution, there have been only a handful of cases discovered in which those prostitutes who were HIV infected passed on the virus to a customer. And in these very few cases, the client was an IV drug user. The conclusion reached by Dr. Ruth Bernstein was this, quote, every major review, without any exception, of female prostitution by the medical authorities of Western nations had concluded that drug-free female prostitutes were not susceptible to HIV and would not be the means of infecting the general population, unquote. The acceptance of this fact, by the way, is reflected in medical statistics. Quote, men and women who are prostitutes do not represent, quote, a risk group with respect to AIDS and are not listed in the hierarchy of risk groups, unquote. According to Dr. Ruth Bernstein, these facts alone lead him to believe, quote, vaginal intercourse and anal forms of sex, by far the most common forms practiced by the prostitutes interviewed, are not high-risk activities for either the acquisition of transmission of HIV and AIDS, unquote. Although that conclusion may be a little broad when based solely on the evidence of prostitutes' infection rates, a second point he urges does seem reasonable. He insists, female prostitutes have not been and cannot be vectors for transmitting HIV and AIDS to a healthy, drug-free, heterosexual population, unquote. The next group it might be useful to observe are the partners of hemophiliacs. Dr. Bernstein stated in the aforementioned Wall Street Journal article that it is generally believed that between 1981 and 1984, when there were no blood tests to screen out HIV and blood transfusions, about, quote, 90% of 15,000 of the hemophiliacs in the United States were infected with HIV, unquote. Now, as I mentioned briefly before, here's another group that if sexual transmission were the norm, should have become pipelines through which AIDS gushed into the wider society, outside of the early high-risk groups. But, quote, hemophiliacs have not become vectors for spreading AIDS into the heterosexual population, unquote. As of January 1992, there were only 104 known cases where HIV was passed to another person by an infected hemophiliac. And as in the case of the clients of prostitutes who went positive, quote, most of the affected individuals have documented assaults on their immune system beyond HIV exposure, unquote. Further, as I mentioned in a magazine piece, given the large number of HIV-positive hemophiliacs, quote, there isn't one study that shows that the wives of hemophiliacs get AIDS from their partners, unquote. And remember, those hemophiliacs who did passed it to individuals who were frequently IV drug users. Although in the next discussion, I will, on our next program in this series, I will focus on some common misperceptions about the existence of AIDS in Africa. We might insert at this point a few words about the situation there, especially because it is said by some establishment figures that while AIDS in the West, as far as it is spread sexually, follows homosexual routes of transmission, in Africa it is primarily moving along heterosexual lines. Although this seems to be true, here, even there, according to Dr. Gischler's examination of the statistics of the World Health Organization for 1994, the chances of getting infected with HIV through heterosexual intercourse are not high. Quote, these figures show that on average, HIV will be transmitted from an infected man to a woman, even at the most unfavorable calculation, once in 700 incidences of sexual intercourse. Unquote. When I interviewed Michael Elliott, and again, I'm not, at this point, I'm not giving the background on these individuals, but that individual's background, all the individuals' backgrounds, will be made available. And you'll see that these people I am quoting, I have reason to quote them because they have done original research in the field and are not merely parroting information from the CDC or one of the other organizations. He further noted that in a 5-year study of 15 to 19-year-old pregnant women in Uganda, quote, supposed to be one of the real hotspots for AIDS in Africa, the figure for HIV infectivity in heterosexuals was on the decline, unquote. We will have more to say about Africa and AIDS in a moment. But if we return to our main focus now, heterosexual transmission in the West, we can conclude that this has turned out to be unexpectedly rare. Just as in Africa, it is not easy to pass HIV by heterosexual intercourse. Several studies have calculated that it takes between 500 to 1,000 unprotected sexual encounters before an HIV-negative partner seroconverts to HIV-positive, unquote. To put this in mathematical terms, we can cite a scientific paper, quote, heterosexual transmission of AIDS, which seems the risk from heterosexual encounters as negligible. We estimate, the article reads, that infectivity from male to female transmission is low, approximately 0.0009% per contact, and that infectivity for female to male is even lower, unquote. Agreeing to this assessment by trying to make the figures more salient, writing in the Academic Journal of Sex Research, Dr. Simon has put this in terms of comparative risks, beginning by noting that for heterosexual intercourse, quote, the risk in the industrialized world at least is not of great magnitude, either in comparison to the major modes of transmission or to other voluntary assumed risks of daily life, such as driving, unquote. According to a Dr. Brody synopsis of Simon's report, quote, having vaginal intercourse without a condom with 5,400 American partners of unknown HIV status but not known to be in a high-risk group would result in lost life expectancy. And that's an epidemiological value used to quantify and compare risks. compared to 12 months lost for being 12 pounds overweight. That means almost impossible. After all, how many people do you know are going to have 5,400 different sexual partners and an unchallenged immune system? Going further, we might note that when heterosexual transmission does seem to take place, it is generally from the male to the female, not the other way around. Quote, in the United States, for instance, in a period of over 10 years, 1984 to 1994, there have been only 11 documented cases of female-to-male transmission out of a total of 30,943 positive men. The low transmission rate is the same if we narrow the local focus of our study to the Big Apple, New York City, one of the epicenters of the disease. According to Neville Hodgkinson, in New York City, out of 21,421 men with AIDS, as of the 2nd of March 1990, the number said to have acquired the disease from sex with women at risk was only 8. That's 8 men out of 21,000, unquote. Looking at some of the annual statistics, according to Farber, would give us the results like this. Quote, adult cases of AIDS in New York City in 1990 as a result of female-to-male transmission totaled 1. In 1991, there were none, unquote. As Dr. Siminski summarized, even if all of the 3,328 men and 5,545 women with AIDS in the United States in 1998 who report heterosexual contact as their sole risk for making accurate reports, it is important to note that these numbers would contribute only in the small measure to the total health risks facing heterosexuals. When, unquote, when I interviewed Hodgkinson, he pinpointed this limited spread of AIDS among heterosexuals as one of the key determinants pressing scientists to rethink AIDS theory. In his words, one of the factors that strengthened the case for looking again at the HIV theory was that over the years, it became clear, despite continued protestations to the contrary, that AIDS was not spreading outside of the original risk groups. The normal sexually transmitted disease would have eventually been found equally distributed between both sexes. But, as he said, it hasn't been like that in the countries most affected by AIDS. It has stayed confined to the original risk groups. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Nall, presenting information that is scientifically based. After the most comprehensive investigative report I've done in my career, it has taken nearly 16 years to complete this research, to present this in an ongoing series of special reports. To keep the flow of this commentary, I'm going to simply, instead of using the quotes, saying quote and then end quote, I'll simply try to give the brief reference to the individual and that person's background will be available on my webpage, GaryNall.com, for additional interest and people who want to take this further in establishing the degree of credibility of the sources I use. Now, I might mention that to suggest, as I am, that a person is not acquiring HIV or AIDS through intercourse does not mean that that is not also suggesting that a person could stay risk-free. It would be of other disease, it would be irresponsible. You can contract hepatitis and herpes and cytomegalovirus and Epstein-Barr virus and syphilis and gonorrhea and papilloma and many other sexually transmitted diseases with unprotected sex. So it's not a matter of being unprotected. You should be protected with sex, also for unwanted pregnancies. But these are two distinctly different issues. And also keep this in mind. If AIDS were evolved from unprotected sex, then it would also show that we should have sexually transmitted disease at about the same rate, because we have rampant, as AIDS, we have rampant sexually transmitted disease. We've continued to increase in sexually transmitted disease cases, but we have not continued to increase in AIDS cases. But if it's transmitted sexually through unprotected sex, then why, if you're getting syphilis or hepatitis with unprotected sex, why aren't you getting AIDS? Why aren't you getting HIV? Simply examine the facts. Let's examine the evidence that AIDS is spread by anal intercourse. To a degree, the exaggerated predictions about heterosexual spread of AIDS stem from an erroneous calculation that, as with most sexually transmitted diseases, the immunodeficiency syndrome would spread with equal facility through all types of sexual intercourse. However, a second reason for this mistaken generalization about HIV transmission arose from HIV-positive individuals who either gave false reports or were not questioned in enough depth. In the 1990 book, AIDS and Sex, editors Bruce Bollier and June Rinich and Michael Gottlieb brought out one such case of insufficient meticulous research. They state, government researchers published data indicating that United States Armed Forces personnel infected with HIV had caught the virus from prostitutes, triggering calls for increased campaigns against prostitution. When infected soldiers were interviewed by non-military researchers whom they trusted, it became clear that nearly all had been infected through intravenous drug use or homosexual contact, acts for which they could be expelled from the armed services, which prevented them from being candid with the original military researchers. In each of these flawed published studies, researchers, journal editors, and peer reviewers failed to correct mistakes that shouldn't have been recognized. A second cause of misdiagnosis is that in discussing AIDS, we are using heterosexual intercourse as shorthand for vaginal sex and homosexual intercourse as a signifier of anal sex. In both instances, though, this is a simplification, since, for example, both groups can engage in oral sex, and heterosexual couples may experiment with anal sex, although vaginal sex is the statistical norm. Many of those that believe HIV is spread sexually see it as passed by anal sex, regardless of the sexual orientation of the couple. For them, we might say, if there were a heterosexual community which exclusively practiced anal sex, its numbers would be at risk of getting AIDS as any male homosexual group. Mutatis mutandis, a gay community which only practiced oral sex, would be classified as low risk. Although we are unlikely to find such communities, there are a good percentage of heterosexuals who practice anal sex. And it's argued by some students of the topic that it is this percentage who account for what heterosexuals spread of the disease will do have. This is backed up by a comprehensive study published in the Archives of Sexual Behavior, which indicated that researchers investigating AIDS often fail to ask about anal intercourse, which is often dismissed when heterosexual intercourse is reported as the primary sexual activity. The piece goes on to assert, without clarifying these factors, both heterosexuals' use of anal intercourse and mentioned elsewhere, HIV drug use, it is impossible to assert the existence of purely vaginal transmission of HIV. An article reviewing the work of medical statistician Stuart Brody stresses the possibilities of misinformation inherent in this procedure. HIV researchers who publish these papers do not seem to be serious about accurately accounting for anal intercourse, he says. Brody continues, the very studies that claim to document vaginal transmission show that vaginal intercourse frequently does not correlate with seroconversion, but that frequency of receptive anal intercourse does. This failure of questioners to ask HIV-positive women or heterosexual men about rectal intercourse has unconsciously skewed the figures of those infected by heterosexual intercourse upward. Brody feels, quote, a total liar rate of 5% is more than adequate to account for all the cases of HIV transmission and AIDS which are classified as heterosexual. So even the heterosexual transmission of AIDS, when you account for the 5% of people out of 100% that would be lying about how they got their transmission, would account for virtually all the heterosexual transmission. That is to say, he discounts vaginal transmission altogether, preferring to believe that the rare seroconversion observed in HIV vaginal transmission studies represents participants who have not been forthright in their self-appraisal of risk exposure, or who have not been asked the specific questions that would have identified their risks. As an example of a positive who might be disingenuous about his answers, he mentions a man who had been raped in prison. Men like this, he says, might not consider themselves to have ever had sex with a man, but nonetheless, it would have been the anal, not other instances of vaginal sex by which the virus was transmitted. I expect, Brady Stotes states, if the reporting of behavior of HIV positives was accurate, the true HIV rate of Americans who engage only in vaginal sex would be far less than 1 in 7,500. Putting this in more picturesque terms, CEO opinions, a risk-free American who has a single act of unprotected sex with a random risk-free partner is about as likely to become HIV positive as being struck multiple times by lightning in 1 year or winning several state lotteries from one ticket. Statisticians would call the vaginal passing of the virus secondary transmission, which occurs when a person not in a primary risk group acquires AIDS from someone in such a group, such as when a male HIV drug user passes HIV to a non-drug using female through vaginal sex. Secondary transmission of any type constitutes only 3% of all AIDS cases ever reported in the United States. To return to the article in Archives, we find it notes heterosexual and anal intercourse is common. It gives as representative figures that about 18% of North American college women have had anal intercourse, while in Denmark, 36% of women between the ages of 20 and 30 have experienced anal intercourse. It is held to be significant that these numbers are close to about 20% of male-to-female transmission rate reported among monogamous heterosexual couples, with one partner being an HIV-positive male. The possibility that anal intercourse is the way HIV infection is passed among heterosexuals is supported by a European study that has shown the relative risk to women of becoming HIV-positive through sex with an HIV-positive partner is increased more than fivefold in anal intercourse compared to vaginal intercourse. The data from this investigation indicated 46% of women who had anal intercourse with HIV-positive partners became HIV-positive. Dr. Bruce Vollier mentions, by the way, that in the notorious story of Kimberly Burgalis, in which she claimed to have contracted AIDS during a single dentist visit to the infected Dr. David Asser, Burgalis was found to have venereal warts on the anus upon being autopsied. Now, these can be contracted only by anal intercourse. This in spite of the fact that she testified before Congress that she was a virgin. Perhaps vaginally she was. To get back to the archive study, it adduces a real why anal intercourse may be the more likely route of transmission. This has nothing to do with sexual proclivities, but with the possible health hazards. The article argues, there's no question that anal intercourse and unsterile HIV activity are the main vectors of HIV transmission and are the behaviors associated with those people in the primary risk groups. During both of these activities, the protective skin barrier is compromised, something that does not happen during normal vaginal intercourse. The rectal tissue is more permeable than that of the vagina, and HIV transmission in those having anal intercourse has been directly related to the amount of rectal trauma experienced. Those that agree with this reading of the available data would be inclined to narrow the range of the susceptible even more, so that it would not be engaging in anal intercourse itself that put one at risk, but being the receptive rather than the active partner. This is because the rectal trauma that was said to facilitate transmission would only be possibly suffered by the receptive consort. Let's follow Neville Hodgkinson's analysis of material that supports this viewpoint. He notes that by 1987, researchers reported in The Lancet that anal intercourse put one in danger, but the risk was almost exclusively confined to receptive partners. Another set of studies tracked a large number of HIV-negative homosexual men, noting both their sexual patterns and retesting them to see if any became positive over a six-month period, it says. Of men who did not engage in receptive anal intercourse within 6 months before the start of the study and during the six-month follow-up, only 0.5%, that's only 3 out of 646 seroconverted to HIV. By contrast, of men who engaged in receptive anal sex with two or more partners during each of the six-month period, 10% seroconverted. No seroconversions were seen in 220 homosexual men who did not practice anal intercourse at all during the 12 months. It was also discovered that HIV risks for the receptive partners would increase depending upon their number of partners. Those who had five or more partners would increase their risk 18-fold. On the other hand, those men that reduced or stopped receptive anal intercourse decreased their risk by becoming seropositive, or becoming seropositive. According to this side of the argument, and remember, we said there is other research would undercut this position. A key means of risk enhancement is anal intercourse. The unexpected paucity of cases of heterosexual transmission in the West, this side believes can be explained by the fact that vaginal intercourse is not a likely or feasible means of spreading HIV. That said, let us look at counterarguments, both of those who say hands down HIV is not sexually transmitted, and those who, while agreeing it can be spread through anal sex, feel this can only take place for an individual who combines recipient intercourse with other unrelated risk factors, such as infection with sexually transmitted diseases and drug use. Let's first look at the one. The evidence AIDS is not spread by anal intercourse. If the HIV virus does move from body to body through intercourse, then it stands to reason that it would have been transmitted through sperm. But there's a factor that those who vouch for the sexual transmission of AIDS are hard put to explain. The amount of HIV in semen of positives is extremely low. In a study of the sperm of 25 antibody-positive men, only one single provirus of HIV could be found in 1 million cells in only one of the 25 men. No evidence of HIV was found in the other 24 men. In a study done in 1992 of 95 men with HIV, only 9 of the patients showed evidence of virus in their sperm. Finally, a study from 1991, which appeared in the medical journal Fertility and Sterility, ended with the same conclusions. It states, semen samples of 25 HIV-positive men were studied, and it was discovered that only 4 showed any trace of HIV. And at that, a tiny infinitesimal, statistically non-relative amount. On this front, the evidence for sexual transmission seems to go the other way from what would have been expected if HIV were being moved through semen. Dr. Geisler states, so far there has not been any evidence, for example, molecular biological evidence, which proves that HIV has been transmitted through semen, which in infected men contains only tiny quantities of HIV. A second difficulty facing the anal of the anal sex transmission theory brings us back to the same set of facts that were being brought up in the strong support of it. According to the theory, one fact that was biasing some to believe that there was heterosexual HIV spread was that many heterosexual couples engage in anal intercourse, which is not reported to interviewers. This, according to them, is the reason HIV positivity is sometimes found among a small group of heterosexuals. But the opponents ask, if heterosexuals are often engaging in anal intercourse, which they agree is undoubtedly true, why is the extent of HIV positivity among them so incredibly low? In Continuum magazine, a Mr. Klein talked to a number of doctors who make this argument. According to a Dr. Bruce Voller, the U.S. female population between 15 and 64 in 1987 was about 81 million. If, following common statistics, about 10% of women frequently engage in anal intercourse, then this would put 8 million women at risk. Voller states, this startling number of women at risk through anal intercourse probably exceeds the number of homosexual men at similar risk. What then accounts for the vast difference in the number of AIDS cases between the two groups? Dr. Culloden has the same question. He says that while anal intercourse is frequently performed in heterosexual couples, and the heterosexual population is many times larger than the homosexual population, nevertheless, AIDS is not associated with heterosexual anal sex. It could also be said that if anal sex alone is all that is necessary for contracting the virus, then even among the gay population, the figures are not as high as would have been expected.
That was somewhat of a shortened edition, a truncated edition of Natural Living with Gary Null. We had some technical problems connecting with him in Florida, but not to fear. Back with us on Monday at 12 noon. That was one of the series of programs that Gary has produced called AIDS: A Second Opinion. And we want to let you know about what's happening over the weekend. You can tune in to WBAI's Out FM, New York City's only radio program which covers local, national, and international coverage on the lesbian, gay, intersexual communities every Sunday evening at 6:30 p.m., serving all of New York City and the tri-state area as well, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, as well as Pennsylvania. So, tune in to that.
The importance of media. But he's also, I just said, understands it. Those who own it control it. And, you know, all these other companies are having these IPOs and selling off this and being taken over by that. And he's still the sole owner of John H. Johnson Publications. And it's, you know, they have publishing in addition to the magazines. They have their whole division, book publishing, Ebony Fashion Fair. There are so many different things going. It's I salute him this afternoon, since I have the time the opportunity to. Another one I'd like to pay tribute to is the great, wonderful writer Toni Morrison, who recently in New York City celebrated her 70th birthday. Woo! Happy birthday. I think she is just a wonderful, wonderful, enormous talent and an enormous person. And I'm so happy. I wasn't at the birthday celebration, but I saw a wonderful picture. And you could just see that light, so much light in her face that it was just... It was great. Happy birthday. It's speaking of, and one other thing, when I was saying early on about Lester Bowie, someone's telling me he's from Brooklyn, died recently. But I didn't realize that, and I knew he had gone to Europe and had been, you know, sort of retooling some of his ideas with some of his music, and he came up with this. I just think it's this great album, the one we played the opening from, and I wanted to get that in that he's a local person. One of the things that I've been doing recently myself, on a personal level, is some work at the Schomburg Library with black journalists. My generation of journalists, for those of you who don't know Earl Caldwell, I'm a newspaper man, have been all my life, starting out in the late 1950s in the mountains of Pennsylvania, Clearfield Progress, to the Lancaster Intelligencer Journal, to the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, the New York Herald Tribune, the New York Post, the New York Times, the New York Daily News, the Washington Star. I think I just about got them all. So you see, I say all that to say I'm a newspaper junkie. And one of the things is that because, as I said, the newspaper always looks out. You never get a chance to look inside. You don't really know a lot of the stories, the inside stories, or as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. And so at the Schomburg Library, the Schomburg Center in Harlem, 135th and Lenox, I am a part of an effort headed by the Maynard Institute in partnership with the library to put together an oral history of those black journalists who broke through in the white media in the mid-1960s. You know, largely before then, the media was all white men. Even as Kerner Commission in the late 68 said, that's the media's trouble. It's everything is reported through the eyes of the white man. That's it. So we've begun to put together this oral history. And it's been a remarkable experience for me, an exhilarating one, working with the library, but mostly working with and listening to and revisiting these journalists from those times and those stories and those places. And I think it will be a truly remarkable collection at the library, the Schomburg. They have a